tree branch or some roots, something like that.
Matt Kerwin is the director of the Coastal Geomorphology and Ecology Lab at the Virginia Institute of Marine Science at William & Mary. This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back. Welcome back to With Good Reason from Virginia Humanities. Angel Garcia says his whole life has been about caves. He grew up in Puerto Rico, where caves hold a special cultural significance. And now he's a geologist at James Madison University. He journeys with us into the dark and cool depths of a cave. There, the eerie quiet is broken by drips of water that form stalactites and stalagmites. Garcia studies these cave sculptures and their drips to uncover mysteries from our planet's past.
Caves are really, really important part of the topography, part of the terrain in the Caribbean. For the people who were pre-colonial people, the Taino people, one of the creation stories, it is saying that there were two caves made by one of the spirits, and one of the caves that is called Casibajagua is where people like me, my family came from, right? And the other cave is where other people who are not like me came from, right?
Like me.
Yeah, you came from the other cave. That right. It's called Amayauna. But actually, in modern language, there is this saying that is just, it is making reference to that creation story, right? It's using in a context the word Huacara, that is interpreted as a cave. Te conozco desde el tiempo de las huácaras, right? I know you from the time of the huácara. And that's really special, right? Because you know that person from the time of the beginning. That's a really long time.
So take me with you, take listeners with you, as though we're going into that cave for the first time with you. What you see, how large the caverns are, and especially what you begin to hear.
Let me describe my trip to Cueva Los Gemelos. It is called the Twins Cave. So when you start getting into the front of the cave, right, headlights are getting on and you start getting into darkness. And there is one point that actually you need to walk really close to the ground, right? That you cannot walk straight. And at the end of this transect, you will find that the cave open again. It looks like a 600 people auditorium. It's really big, right? But when you get here, right, you start exploring in some places you see stalactites forming and you see all this process, right, going on. But as more as you start getting exploring this cave, there is this small refuge, right, this little cave inside of the cave that when you get your head in, and actually you can see it right a little bit in the ground and just look in through this refuge, you will find this beautiful image. It is an image of what it seems to be twin brothers being wrapped in a blanket. It is such a simple but at the same time complex drawing.
As you withdraw from seeing the image in the small cave of the twins, what do you begin to see and hear?
It's getting darker. Your senses start changing with every minute as more longer or deeper you get into caves. I want to focus in a little bit on the eyes, right, on the vision. Think about that somebody's asking you to turn off the headlamp, the source that you have in order to help your eyes to see, right? Have you been in a room that is so dark that there is no difference? There's literally no difference between having your eyes open or closed. You just feel your eyelids moving, right? Opening in or closing. As you are in this complete dark room, remember that your headlamp is off. you start listening to other things of your body. Other senses are start getting amplified, right? Like, for example, if you are moving your boot in the ground, that you hear the dirt, right? That is kind of interacting with your boot. You're aware of your breathing, right? In a sense that I am breathing really loud or this is calm, right? You start getting sense of your own interaction with the environment. And as more progress, not just darkness, but also complete silence, you start listening to your heart. You start listening more to other parts of your body that are just right in tune with this or amplified by the silence of the cave. Now I want you to get away from listening to parts of you, right? And start listening to the cave. You have it at distance, that really far drop. It is so beautiful to listen because you can't predict the rhythm, right? It is so constant, and you just want to listen more. And in some places, in some other caves that I have this experience, you have other rhythms of caves that are a little bit, the dripping that's a little bit faster. But in absolute silence, right, that sound is really amplifying. It becomes really something that your ears and right your audition want to capture the more that you can. So now think in other environments that now you have drips combined together, different rhythms. Or in locations that you can have water flowing. And this will be the sound of a living cave, what they call una cueva viva, right? A living cave.
What else is inside the cave?
So the more that you start getting aware of the sounds of your environment, in some places you can listen to the bats flapping their wings next to you or just, right, making sounds. Now everybody's gonna be turning on their headlamps. So you're a little bit kind of like, oh, this is too bright, right? And even no light is getting to your face, it's just your eyes are adjusting back into the light, even though if it's a little bit of light, right, in the far away. And after that, you don't look things the same way, right? Because now you start paying attention more with your eyes, also with your ears, or in combination with your eyes.
I understand that geologists can actually find a kind of natural record of climate, ancient climate, and climate change through caves.
Yeah, think about when you cut a tree, right? When you slice a tree and you can see what you learn in elementary school, that tree has rings, right? And every ring is making reference to a year, but also the thickness are making reference to dry periods or more, right, more heavy rain and things like that, right? What is really interesting, if you cut a stalactite, you will find these different layers being forming with the action of the drip from the roof or from a stalactite in the top. So we can look at the mineral that is formed, and we can look these elements of carbon and oxygen. And if we put this in a constraint of time, what we call an age model, you can make interpretation of regional or even local or regional changes that are related to the climate. This is what we call proxy, right? If you have these variations, it can mean that it was a more drier period. It could be it was more a wetter period. It could be that you have a more forested area in top of the cave. It can be that you have a less forested area in top of the cave. This information, this archive of knowledge are inside of caves. In Puerto Rico, back home, caves are portals to connect back with the people who were there before. Time passes different inside of a cave.
Angel Garcia is a professor of geology at James Madison University. Deborah Waller is a biologist at Old Dominion University. She brings us up close and personal with some of our smallest neighbors, ants, bees, and termites. We join her at the Wyanoke Bird and Wildlife Sanctuary in Norfolk, Virginia, to tour the mini ecosystems found inside dead trees and logs.
There's so many different species of insects, and they're so important to the functioning of the earth. And we are just paving over the earth. We're destroying their habitat. It's devastating what we're doing to insects, and people don't realize it. They don't realize the value of insects, and they don't realize what they're doing. Just, you know, making a beautiful green lawn using pesticides and fertilizers, you're just destroying habitat that could be wildflowers for butterflies and bees and all kinds of insects. Okay, I'm back at a dead snag.
What's a snag?
Well, snag is a stump, essentially.
I previously put out a piece of chocolate chip cookie and grape jelly in a little nook, and now it is full of black carpenter ants on the edge of the jelly, drinking it up. And there should also be some other ant species that I saw previously, the acrobat ant. But it looks like in this case, the carpenter ants have taken over the bait.
You know, when I see carpenter ants, I think trouble, but you loved seeing them there.
Oh, carpenter ants are wonderful. And most carpenter ants do not eat fresh wood, or regular wood. So for example, if you have ants in your house, carpenter ants in your house, then that means that you've got a leak someplace and you've got wet wood that is rotting, and the carpenter ants are just showing you where it is. So carpenter ants are not fearsome and something that's going to come in and destroy your house. They're going to show you where the damage is.
Now I'm at a dead log that I'm lifting up, and immediately a salamander skittles away.
I just loved insects from day one. Was always looking to find out where they were and looking for new ones.
There's some sow bugs.
And I had a neighbor boys who loved looking for insects too. So, you know, we'd go out and explore.
Another salamander seemed to be very abundant here today.
In the very beginning, we had a pet spider outside our house when I was very little. And so at that point, realized that, you know, they're just wonderful, all the arthropods that are out there. And then later on, I found something that I called a glue bug because it was like sticking to me. It was a beetle, was actually a weevil. And I was just so fascinated by it. And then after that, I just was looking for insects every place.
I'm peeling the bark away from a log, and it is full of termites. And I see both soldiers and workers. And these look like the Eastern Subterranean termite, which is a very common species in this area. So they're all running around trying to figure out where to go now that the colony has been exposed. So I'm going to put the bark back so they can have a little peace.
They are a social species, eusocial. They live in colonies with a king and a queen. And they make reproductives every year. They have workers and soldiers. They're really amazing. The ones around here are subterranean, so we really rarely see them above ground unless we look into logs. But around the world, they build these huge structures, and they're just little teeny termites building these huge, massive structures out of earth that they just, you know, put in the right place and, you know, put saliva in there and cement it together. They're just really incredible insects.
I'm rolling over another branch, and I see a long, black, skinny organism wriggling underneath the log, and that is a millipede. So millipedes are very interesting. They often can produce cyanide to deter somebody from eating them, but otherwise they're fairly defenseless.
They're not really good at running away, and in fact, most millipedes will just curl into a ball, and so they can release cyanide so that if a predator tries to eat it, it gets a bad taste and or bad odor too, and runs off.
I just found another log that is covered in sawdust, and there's piles of sawdust underneath, and I actually see the sawdust maker, which is a pisalid beetle. Sometimes they're called patent leather beetles. They're very large, maybe the length of your thumb, and they're shiny black. And they live in family groups. So the father and mother rear the young and they protect them. And if somebody tries to bother them, they make a squeaking sound to chase them away.
I'm amazed by that. There are insects that parent together?
Oh, yes, yes. Actually, some cockroaches do it also, but these pisalid beetles, the male and the female live together, they rear their big grub babies, and they actually help them throughout their lives so that when they're ready to pupate, they go and pile frass and sawdust around them so that the larva can roll around in it and have kind of a grip so it can pupate.
Have you ever heard the squeak?
Yes, I have. I've actually tried to make the squeak for you, but they hid in a crevice before I could hold it. If you hold it up to your ear, they go ee ee ee. They make other sounds too. We don't know what most of them mean. So the sound that you hear when you pick them up is defensive, but they make other squeaking sounds that probably communicate with each other, but we don't know a lot about those.
So I lifted up the bark of another log, and not only is it full of termites, but some of the termites are in the alate stage, or the nymph stage, going to become alates. And you can tell because they're longer and white, and they're getting ready to become either males or females who will be the reproductives and go on a mating flight. So there are some soldiers in here too, because they're gonna protect them, and some workers because they are taking care of them, but they're all waiting for the mating flight, which shouldn't happen very long from now.
Are termites important for the forest ecosystem?
Oh, they are incredibly important. Yes, because they tunnel throughout the earth. They bring water up from deep resources. They bring nutrients up from deep resources. They're very important for soil fertility and soil aeration. And many, many things eat termites. Virtually everything will try to eat a termite. And they are just so important in the food chain. They're just extremely important in nature.
It seems also so are fallen logs, right?
Absolutely. We heard recently with the California wildfires that some politicians were saying, well, we need to rake the forest and get rid of all those logs that are fire hazards, but they're not. Actually, I've worked in an area that has fallen logs as part of the ecosystem, and we would have prescribed burns. So the burn would like race through the forest and get rid of all the little twigs and things like that. But the logs you'd open them up and there'd still be termites and ants sitting in there. They'd be fine. The logs themselves are not part of the fire hazard. They're actually communities there that are returning the nutrients to the soil.
As I walk along the path in the preserve, I see many holes, big round holes, and these are ground nesting bees who have emerged and are out searching for nectar sources and pollen to rear their young.
what they will do is like get pollen and nectar and we call that provisioning, put that in the tunnel and then lay an egg on it and then they'll wall that off and then put another one next to it. And so different species of ground nesting bees use different materials to wall it off. But the bees I was looking at are called mining bees, and they just have a tunnel that goes down, and then they'll make little side cells and put the babies in each of these side cells. I just watched a bee crawl into her hole, so they're very active, clearing out their holes, coming out, going back in. I only saw that one. Oh, here's another one, flying. They can memorize where the hole is. They often use landmarks to do this. And so they fly around trying to recognize their landmarks, and then they go down into their holes. They would not be welcome if they went into the wrong hole. One of them is sitting in the entrance to her hole, staring at me. Just now when I started speaking, she scuttled back down inside the hole. But they're keeping an eye on me. I'm sure they're worried that I'm up to no good. Further along the path, over a patch of ivy, I see a huge number of male solitary bees swarming around, just searching for the females, because this is the time of year that they would mate so that the females would then go on to rear the young.
These insects really are, dare I say, sentient. What are they?
Oh, they are sentient. Oh, absolutely. They have so many mental capabilities that we never appreciated before. Where I was looking, there were holes everywhere, and yet each bee knew her own hole because she had memorized the landmarks, what twig, you know, what stem was nearby.
Do you think they experience any grief?
My feeling about insects is that if they feel distress, which we know they can, that's, to me, that's the same as grief. I think that, you know, it's hard to know what even another human feels, but insects feel distress when they're captured or cornered or preyed upon, and it's difficult for them, as grief is difficult for us. I don't try to say that it's exactly the same, but I do know distress when I see it. So I'm back at the snag, which had the cookie and grape jelly bait and the carpenter ants are gone, and now the acrobat ants are here. And they are carrying away pieces of cookie. So apparently the carpenter ants got what they wanted, and now the others can come and take their turn. We could not live in the world without the insects. And we need to give them a place to live and to appreciate them. And it really doesn't take much. You know, in your own yard, you can, instead of having a nice green lawn, you can have bare patches for like the bees to nest in. You can have old stems where other bees nest. You can have all kinds of different wildflowers for different species of bees and butterflies. It's just very important to use what you have and to make it available to as wide a variety of insects as possible.
Deborah Waller is a biologist at Old Dominion University. Support for With Good Reason is provided by the University of Virginia Health System, pioneering treatments to save lives and preserve brain function for stroke patients, uvahealth.com. With Good Reason is produced by Virginia Humanities, which acknowledges the Monacan Nation, the original people of the land and waters of our home in Charlottesville, Virginia. Our production team is Allison Quantz, Matt Darrow, Lauren Francis, and Jamal Milner. Maya Neer and Cassandra Deering are our interns. Special thanks to Jenny Taylor for booking assistance. For the podcast, go to withgoodreasonradio.org. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.
Listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 9:59 a.m. Next up is American Standoff with Jacqueline Keeler.